Welcome to Beyond Standards, your source for authentic discussions about the world of teaching. Get ready to explore challenges, share inspiring stories, and discover strategies that will empower you to make a lasting impact on your students. Here are your hosts, who are trying to master the fine art of maintaining their sanity while managing a classroom, Joe Rohrhoff and Jeff Bologna.
Welcome, welcome, dear listeners. I'm Joe, your friendly neighborhood teacher, and by my side is the man, the myth, the legend of middle school mastery, Jeff. Jeff, how's your superhero cape holding up today?
Wow. Wow, Joe, that was quite the intro, Joe. Thank you for, the legend, the myth, the man. Joe, there's no way you wrote that.
I got a confession to make. I had a little inspiration. Our PD this week was about AI, and so I asked ChatGPT to help me out a little bit. I told them we needed to spice up our intro a little bit, and they came up with a lot of nice things about you, which I never would have, but that somehow ChatGPT doesn't know much about Jeff Bologna. They must think you're some kind of superhero, because that's what they called you.
Joe, the dead giveaway was the positive comments that you made, because I don't know if I've ever heard anything that positive come out of your mouth and towards me. But that was awesome, ChatGPT. Joe, that's funny. That PD, I always judge PD on if I can take something and use it the next day. I thought the PD on Monday that we went through with the AI, I learned stuff that I could have brought into the classroom on the very next day. Yeah, that was. I know, and that's a whole nother episode that we can do all on AI in and out of the classroom and accepting it. But I know we've got some things going today, and why don't we just jump right into it, Joe?
Yeah, I can't wait for that future episode on AI. But for today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to explore some current events that affect teachers, affect students, parents, and communities across the country. In this episode, we're going to uncover some of the headlines that you'll see on the educational landscape across the country, and we've got three stories we're going to bring to you today, or I guess three articles that we read that we're just going to, reflect on as teachers that are in the education space. And the first one is going to be the government takeover of the Houston School District, and then we're going to talk about a teacher strike that's currently going on over in Oregon. And lastly, we're going to end up with, you could call it a book banning issue. It's about the book fair company that I remember from a middle school student that I think is the same company that our school uses, Scholastic, who has recently taken a section of diverse books, and we'll talk about what that means a little later, but they took them and kind of segregated them from the rest of their collection and allowed school districts to opt out of having them. So there's a school district in Michigan, just about an hour away from where we're at in Okemos, that is protesting that, or that is upset about that. And we'll talk about that a little bit. So let's get ready to unpack the latest in educational news. But Jeff, why don't we introduce our guest that we have today?
Thank you, Joe. That's awesome. Yeah. When we were going through these things, and, I picture today's episode just about us sitting around the lunchroom talking about what's going on in the news. And right away, I couldn't think of a better person to talk about this, especially because some of the stuff, relates to teacher unions and things like that. And we have one member of our staff at our school, Joe, who is always on the forefront of, everything that's going on in the world of education and just in the world in general. So it's my pleasure to introduce our Spanish 1 teacher at the middle school level, Sarah Dibian. Welcome to the show, Sarah. We're so happy you're here.
Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Joe. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited. And before I introduce our first topic, I do want to say that obviously all three of these topics are topics that can be very politically charged. We're not trying to turn this into a political podcast. We're just a couple of teachers reflecting on some things. And obviously, we're going to have our biases as teachers. But at the same time, I feel like, teachers' opinions are undervalued when it comes to things like this, even though that we're the boots on the ground every single day. And it's opinions like ours and our fellow teachers that really these politicians and should be listening to. So I just wanted to throw that out there. But let's jump right into our first article. And this, our first one comes from the Associated Press. And of the three today, this is the oldest. This one comes, the article comes from the beginning of the school year, but it's this ongoing thing that I know we'll be updating, and that is the state takeover of Houston's public school district over in Texas. And if you're not familiar with a state takeover in the education system, it's basically when a state government recognizes or identifies a school as underperforming for whatever reason. It could be related to things like test scores. It could be mismanagement of funds. Those are some things that are typically targeted in these state takeovers. But this has happened recently in Texas, just, you know, this school year. So this is pretty fresh. There's a lot of people out there that say, yeah, this is great. It's great that obviously this school district has been identified as one that's struggling. So something needs to change. And there's a lot of people that argue against that, saying that, yeah, they agree something needs to change, but that this is not the change. And some of the things that they argue, some of the negatives that come up with this. In this school district, in the Houston school district, one of the things they did is they transformed the libraries basically into spaces for discipline. So instead of going to the library to get a book, it becomes a place where you go when you're being punished. Another thing, teachers' performance is now being monitored through in-classroom cameras. So they're using classroom cameras to keep an eye on the teachers. I know that's not something teachers are going to like, having Big Brother looking over their shoulder, you know, throughout the entire day. Teacher pay is now being tied largely to standardized test scores. And they're disbanding a lot of support services, including support services for an autistic group of students and other groups of students that are the ones that need that support the most. And a lot of people complain that they're just shifting the focus to discipline rather than instruction in the classroom. And that's been largely the focus of what they're doing. So that's just kind of a quick summary of what's going on in Houston. And I'd love to hear you guys just kind of, what's your reaction to that? Maybe your reaction to the state takeover or some of those, the effect it might have on the local community. Sarah, why don't you go first?
Which part should we start with?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I know.
There is quite a bit to unpack. I think, the biggest thing that jumps out to me as an educator is to really think about the value that they're putting in their educators, or the lack thereof, and how those teachers are probably feeling very lost and not really knowing where they're going to go. Teachers, wherever they're at, invest in whatever community they're in. And for a state to come over and take over and change all ways of being, it sounds like, just has to be devastating to these teachers. In a world that we're living in with a teacher shortage, it's unbelievable to me that this would be the way that they go. So I think that's one of the biggest things I look at right away is, wow, if that was me, those would be really hard, really, really hard on so many aspects.
Sarah, yeah, I agree with Sarah totally about that. But I also look at the impact that it will have on the kids, right? Because as educators, we're always taught to like look at it from the kids' lens, right? Like if how does this impact the kids? How are they going to suffer or gain? What do they have to gain from this? And, you know, I think I was reading this article, Joe, earlier today, doing some prep, and the quote that stands out to me in the article, it mentions how teachers are going to follow a scripted curriculum with in-class cameras monitoring, which at that point, it that whole relationship piece is gone, and we've done multiple episodes on the relationship building, and that's just gone if they're just going to give me a script to read. But then when you read on, it talks about the superintendent who was appointed there, talks about how he has this new education system thing. And so then you ask the question of, okay, is there a money trail here? What is going on here? Is he going to start trying to push this out throughout the whole state? And then what is the impact that has on the kids, right? Because we all know the three of us are teachers, and we do it for the kids, right? I mean,
sure.
That's why I got into this profession. And hopefully any young teachers or new teachers that are listening, you realize like that's the central focus every day is those kids in front of you. And I don't know how, if I was a parent in the Houston, you know, school district, I would be furious at the impact it will have on my child.
I agree with that 100%. When you look at some of these, Sarah brought up the teacher shortage. This is not going to attract candidates. Hey, come here to this school and read this script while we film you. That doesn't sound like a very appealing job opportunity for anyone coming in. That's not going to draw in the best candidates. And the focus, I feel like when legislators make decisions like this, they search for something that they can kind of reach on to measure things. And what do they reach on to? Test scores. Standardized tests every time. And these districts, Houston in particular, but I've read about a lot of other districts that were taken over. These are underprivileged districts to begin with. They're like, the needs of these students are not as simple as, hey, let's focus more on the tests. There's deeper issues that, you know, if you start reading from a script, you're not going to get to the bottom of those issues. If you're reading curriculum from a script, you're not going to connect with the kids and find out what that kid really needs. You're going to shove more math and reading in their face, and they're going to revolt to that. They're not going to accept that. They're going to kind of push back on that.
Well, it's dehumanizing education. It's taking out all the factors. I think one of the things I read in there also was that there was a timeline and a very strict guidelines of what was to be taught. You know, if we look at best practices in education, if your kids aren't getting something, you go back and you reteach it the next day another way, or another day after that, whatever it takes to help them to understand it. So taking those aspects of education away and lesson planning and putting the human piece into it, the big push we've had, you know, over the years is build those relationships. I don't know how you build a relationship if you're being filmed, the pressure's on to make the scores so that you can get your paycheck. And like, how do you actually reach kids in those circumstances?
And Sarah, if you're basing off of standardized test, a kid has a bad night's sleep, or his mom and dad are fighting, or his parents are going through a divorce, or his dad is going through cancer and having chemo treatments, and he's taking care of himself. And then he comes in the next day to take a standardized test and just doesn't do well. But we're going to judge a teacher.
And we're actually, one of the things that like really stuck out to me was that part of this takeover was because of underperforming test scores. And I'm just curious of how long this trend has been happening, considering that we've all lived through a global pandemic and how much trauma that has put on every single human who has lived through it. Kids are showing learning loss in so many different ways. How can you really judge a school district right now in 2023 when, I mean, we're I don't know what part of the pandemic we're in, but like it had real effects and it still is showing those.
Like I was looking. This article was from the start of the school year, so a little, you know, over a month ago, 2 months ago, about. And I was looking for updates, and so far there's not much that you can find out there on Google. And if there's anyone out there listening in Houston and you want to chime in on this, I would love to hear from you.
Historically, do takeovers work? I mean, we know in our backyard we had the city of Detroit, and you know, you pulled some information and. When it happened here, it didn't show any effect, right? The state came in, you know, they closed a bunch of schools, fired and rehired different teachers. They privatized things. It was all in the name of money because they were bleeding money. And when the takeover ended, they were bleeding even more money. It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, the next question I was going to ask you guys about this is like, what's your prediction for it? And although you didn't specifically answer it, I think we all can agree it's not going to end well. And that's why that the article didn't have it mentioned, hey, this many districts have been taken over and it hasn't been good. So I went and tried to find some specific data. And you mentioned Detroit, because that is in our backyard. And just a couple pieces of data I found from there, because it happened twice in Detroit. The first time from 99 to 2005. And at the time of the takeover in 99, Detroit public schools had modestly increasing enrollment, a positive fund balance, and mid-range scores on standardized tests. And under the reform board, the school district went from having a budget surplus to a $200 million deficit. So they come in to clean the spending, and the opposite happens. If that wasn't bad enough, they decided to try it again in 2009. So from 2009, 2011, I don't know if you guys remember the name Robert Bob. You guys remember guy?
Bob.
Yeah.
He was the guy that came in to take over the district and save the day. And he's the one that came in on his cape with his cape on, not Jeff today.
There it is. But, thank you, Joe.
But he came in with his cape and he ended up closing 59 schools. He fired and rehired hundreds of teachers, counselors, privatized the custodial staff and left DPS with $284 million deficit. And my mom was one of those teachers that was fired and then rehired in DPS. And I can tell you what she had to say about Bob was not positive. I can tell you teacher morale in Detroit at that time was in the gutter. So it was not a successful takeover.
You know, Joe, it's crazy. It you know, and a lot of these decisions are made by people who don't have the boots on the ground and they don't have the equity or the skin in the game, right? Yeah. You know, I don't know if the person in charge of Houston now, Mike Miles, I mean, what skin does he have in the game? What, you know, what experience does he have? You know, everything I'm reading is that he ran a charter school and things like that, which are for profit and
money.
You know, these, right. And I mean, and that's what it comes back down to is, I don't know. I feel like sometimes some of these decisions get made with money in mind and not the kids and the human element, like Sarah said earlier.
Yep. Sarah, any last thoughts on this before we move on to our next one?
I'm sure she's got a lot.
I got lots of thoughts, but I think anytime you take a library away to essentially turn it into a discipline space that in the article equated it to a jail for the day, so that your teacher that's being kept to rigorous standards to check the boxes every day can get through it, you're dehumanizing education. And that's not the business we're in. We work with humans. We are human. So I don't see it working. I really don't.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely make sure we follow up with that one and you know, circle back to it some point between now or maybe in June at the end of the year when we have some more data and we have some more feedback. But let's move on to our second topic for the day. And for that topic, we're going to move over to Oregon. In Portland schools, they are currently closed right now for, I think today is their sixth consecutive day that this school has been closed. And hopefully by the time you're listening to this, it's over. But what's going on there, it's basically a battle between the state lawmakers, the district, and the teachers. There's kind of three sides to this. The district is crying poor. They're saying, we don't have the money to pay the teachers. The state is saying, hey, we just gave you guys, what was it, $10.2 billion. They had a $10.2 billion budget, which is the highest it's ever been. And the state is basically accusing the district of, hey, we gave you all this money. You're spending all of this money on administrative stuff. You're not spending this on things going on in the classroom. And so the state's telling them, we're not giving you any more money to pay your teachers because you're wasting the money we already gave you on administrative stuff, stuff that is not directly impacting kids. And the teachers are asking for a pay raise. The teachers are asking for a 20% salary increase over the next 3 years. They're also asking for more planning time, smaller class sizes. And the district has given in to some of those demands, but they're still, as we talk today, they're still pretty far apart and the kids are still out of school. Teachers are still on strike. You know, it's just not a good situation over there in Portland. What are your thoughts on what's going on over there?
I think it's interesting that they can strike. I actually just did a quick little Google search to find out how many states you can actually strike. There are 37 states in the United States that it's illegal to strike. So the fact that they can actually go on strike in the state of Oregon is kind of a foreign concept to us here in Michigan. We've never, like, throughout our careers, that's not been an option. The fact that they can, I think that more power to them. Hopefully they get some progress with the strike because no one wants to be outside of work. No one wants to go through any of these things, but it sounds like things have gotten a little bit out of control and you just don't say on a whim, okay, we're going on strike. There is definitely a lot of things that led up to this to get to that much of a drastic measure.
Joe, I think you brought up a great point too about the spending and how, you know, the state of Oregon is, you know, claiming, hey, we gave you the money, you need to prioritize it better, right? And that's always, you know, an interesting dilemma. And I've never been in any of those negotiations. I've never been at that admin level. So I don't know what goes into those decision making. But I do know districts always are hiring new people for their board office, or they're hiring this and that. Yet they're shoving 30 more, you know, 33 kids into my classroom when I only have 32 seats or something like that, right? So, and it goes back to what we talked about 2 minutes ago with how it impacts the kids. And here we are again, one more time. And it's like, who is the one being impacted by this? Obviously, the teachers that are on strike because they're losing pay. And I read in there that if they don't settle it by a certain time, they lose their health benefits and they lose. And that could impact their entire family. Right. I get that.
Yeah.
But it's these kids who are out of school. And like you said, Sarah, we're coming out of a global pandemic and there's learning loss. And here we go again. We're sending kids home because, you know, we can't get these things right. I mean, I look at what they're asking and it's like the trifecta of a dream teacher, right? Lower class sizes, more planning time and a raise.
Yeah.
You know, that is your, I mean, I guess when you go on strike, you ask for everything and then you negotiate, right? I think, you know, we're seeing that with the auto strike, you know, the UAW strike that is coming to an end, hopefully. You know, they ask for a lot, but then you negotiate down. And so I don't know. This one's crazy to me that, and like you said, Sarah, all these, that they can still actually strike. When I read this, I was like, whoa, that is weird.
It's huge.
Yeah. So like, how do you think this impacts the teacher community? Because there's people out there bashing these teachers for striking. They're saying, hey, like, you guys are teachers. You're there to support the kids. What's your take on that?
It's hard because, I mean, as teachers who, you know, lived and taught through this past crisis of the pandemic and how we were heroes one day and then not so much the next. I can only imagine the grief that these teachers are getting for walking out of their classrooms and how hard it is for these teachers to do that. It's got to be brutal on all aspects. And I'm sure that all of them just want to settle and get their kids back in the seats and do their jobs. That's what they're there to do and want to do. And we never signed up to be politicians or negotiators as educators, but it comes with the territory. And I think that is really hard for most of us to take on.
Hey, Joe, I think that's an idea for another episode too. The things they don't tell you in college when you're going to school to be a teacher. And then then you're like, oh, hey, by the way, we need you on a negotiating team or we need you to do this. And you're like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Not been trained for that one before.
Yeah.
I'll wing it.
Yeah. You know, but when I look at the numbers though, you know, the neighboring districts that are right around Portland though, they're, you know, the teachers are maxing out at Portland right now. It says 97,000, right? But like neighboring districts are maxing out at 105 or 101, 107. So there is something to be said for there to be some competitiveness too as well, right? Because your goal is to get the best teachers in your buildings. You know, I would hope to God they would try to up that a little bit so you can compete against some of those other areas right around you. I mean, one of them is Beaverton, which I believe Beaverton and Eugene are, you know, where Nike headquarters are, right? So there's all that money there. But, you know, it's still, you got to be competitive.
Every teacher I know wants what's best for kids. There's no teacher like, yes, let's, you know, stay out of school. I can't wait to be out of school for a couple of weeks and be on strike protesting. Every teacher that I know wants what's best for kids. And it's frustrating when teachers get a bad rap for this, for wanting what's best for kids. And it makes me sick that, like, teachers are made to feel guilty for asking for a pay raise. And I feel like sometimes teachers, they have to say, like, yes, it's also about the class sizes and it's about wanting what's best, smaller class sizes, because we know that's best for kids. But then we have this like feeling of guilt if we say, yeah, we want a raise as well. And it is, teachers should not feel guilty for asking to be paid, to be compensated what they're worth and what their value is. And I hate when teachers are made to feel guilty for that. And you know, I came across this when we did our first episode on teachers that were leaving the profession. And it, like, they all had a sense of guilt for saying that they left for a job that paid more. Like, that's okay. We are human beings. We're allowed to do that. And people make us feel guilty for it. Like, we're out to get the kids.
Well, and you also have to make enough money to live. I'm guilty of watching HGTV every once in a while. And there was a show and they were putting a couple teachers up in this 2-bedroom apartment and, like, you know, renovating or whatever. But it was paid for by like the school district to get teachers to be able to like live in the community. And then I saw another thing on like a teacher Facebook group. And it was literally like they were building this school and it was somewhere ritzy in California. But they were building the school, and on the top of the school, they were building like loft apartments so they could have teachers live above the school because the cost of rent is too high for a teacher salary.
Sarah, but on our last,
that's ridiculous.
On our episode about technology, Evan Obrenovic, you know, from Traverse City, him and his wife started in Aspen. And they give their teachers like a $10,000 thing every year or something, or a living expense. And the district, the Aspen School District, has subsidized houses that their teachers live in. And, you know, they could walk, he could walk to his classroom, you know, to his school. But it was just like you said, because they want to get good teachers out there, but the cost of living is so astronomical that they have to do something like that. And I, you know, I think of like someone living in San Francisco. One of my best friends teaches in San Francisco, and I'm like, I don't know how he's doing it, man. And you're right, Joe. You know, are we guilty of asking for, you know, a wage that I can support my family and help pay for my son's college coming up here in 2 years?
You guys bring up a good point, too, with the cost of living, because there's probably teachers listening to this in certain parts of the country that are like, oh, my gosh, I would, you know, I would love to be paid half that in some places. You know, at the same time, you do need to take into account the cost of living where you're at.
It's just an interesting, you know, I like to see how this one plays out, because, you know, the parents want the kids back in the classroom. The teachers want to be back in the classroom. I don't know. We'll see how this one plays out. Sarah, as a union person, how do you see this one playing out?
Oof. I hope that, you know, you said they were asking for, you know, a lot, or, but I hope that they can find some middle ground and get what they deserve. It sounded like from the article I read, they were putting a lot of money into some positions at the top. And that's concerning to me. And there's kind of a trend in that, if you will, in education. So get the money to where it really makes a difference and get it to the kids, because that's who needs it. And the teachers are with them every single day.
Yeah, that's another one we'll follow up with, just like our first story today. Any last thoughts on that, Jeff? Are you ready to move on to number three?
Good. Ready. Yeah.
All right. Well, this one's right up your alley as an ELA teacher.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to comment on this one. This one's a tough one.
Quick summary. So Okemos Public Schools, which again is just about an hour west of where we're at right now, they decided to cancel their Scholastic book fairs that they had planned for this fall, because Scholastic, the book fair company that everyone has probably heard of, has made a choice to segregate. They have what they call diverse books into a separate collection. And a lot of schools are choosing not to include this collection in their book fairs. And it's a decision that Scholastic made this announcement on October 13th. And they've faced a lot of criticism as they start to separate these books that involve diversity, equity, inclusion topics. Well, let me just talk a little bit about some of the books. Among the books in the optional collection are biographies of Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and activist Malala Yousafzai, both of whom are women of color. Other books celebrate different types of families, like children with LGBTQ parents. And Scholastic's point of view, they're saying they took the action because the growing movement to ban certain titles from schools, and the Scholastic is trying to claim, we are out here to protect schools and protect teachers because we don't want the state, whatever state, there's, I forget the number of states, but it's a lot of states that are kind of imposing these book bans, and we want to protect the teachers and the districts from the state coming after them. Okemos is currently looking for ways to kind of bring voices and diverse perspectives into the classroom, but they don't, you know, this is all pretty recent. They don't have a plan or anything that they've released yet. Jeff, we'll start with you this with this one, our ELA teacher. Thoughts?
Oh, man. Thanks, Joe. threw me this one. Well, I got, you know, here's my thoughts. It's like, I applaud Okemos for taking a stand and saying, hey, this isn't right. You know, I applaud Okemos. It says a lot about that community that they can say, hey, you know what? We're not going to participate in this stuff. The other thing that stands out to me, and it's just so ironic that, you know, not to knock Scholastics, right? Because they're trying to cover their behinds. They're trying to protect. And I agree. They're trying to protect, you know, a teacher or a librarian. A kid comes home with a book. Next thing you know, that teacher's getting sued, right? But their plan is to it's called, quote, share every story, lift every voice, which as an English teacher is like the textbook definition of irony. Like, that is the most ironic title, share every story, lift every voice. Yet you have all these districts in the country that are like, I'm not going to share every story and lift every voice. We don't want that in our building. In the article, it says the American Library Association reported from January to August this past year, there were 695 attempts to censor library material. 695, and that number's up 20% from the previous year in 2022. Do I blame Scholastics for this? No, I mean, they're literally stuck between a rock and a hard place. But I got to feel like if you're going to claim to share every story and lift every voice, then do it, right? Put everything out there. Why do we need a separate, hey, don't go over there. It's like the old, when we were growing up, you'd go to Blockbuster Video and they had a curtain and it's like, you can't go behind that curtain because there's adult material. I mean, that's literally what this sounds like to me. Hey, you can't go over to that black corner of the library. There's books over there that are about, you know, African-Americans. Oh, geez. Like, it's wild to me. Again, I applaud Okemos for taking the stand. And it's just sad that that this is what we're coming to.
Yeah, you used the word irony. I could argue that hypocrisy is equally a good word.
Yeah, it is.
Sarah, what do you think?
I just sit here and I question, how did we ever get to this point where we're banning books, where we're trying to censor book fairs that are supposed to be bringing books to kids? You know, Jeff, you said you can't fault Scholastic, but I disagree. I think that, you know, they need to be counterculture and they need to, if they are publishing all of these books, they need to be putting them out there. I don't know if you guys have ever helped set up a book fair, but the books come in these big cases.
Right. Yep.
And you literally have a parent team and they open them up. So like if there was an issue in a school, they could literally like hide the books. So Scholastic doesn't have to have this like diet plan of like, oh, if you want to add this to your, you know, book fair, you can, but you don't have to if you want to censor yours. I just think like Scholastic really needed to take a bigger stance and
that's fair.
Not back off of it. We have kids who have lots of different stories and need to see them all, in my opinion.
I sometimes question too, like parenting, like, hey, if you don't want your kid to buy this book and they bring it home, throw it away. Take it back. Hey, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
I mean, but instead we're going to board of education meetings and we're like pounding the gavel and saying, my child cannot read the Rosa Parks biography. Okay, then don't let them read it. Like, if I don't want my son to have Snapchat, I'm not going to allow him to have Snapchat. That's right. Not that hard. I'm not going to then go to my board of education and be like, you need to ban all social media because my son can't watch it or can't be on it. But the kid next to me can read the books, right? Like,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting fired up on
good.
This one.
Yeah,
Joe.
Yeah. You're not trying to take control away from the parent. You're trying to give the kid the option. And then if the kid brings it home, you're saying, hey, parents, like if a parent doesn't want their kid to have it, that's their parent's right to take that away, to kind of follow up like your Snapchat example. But
go ahead.
Why is the school the one pulling that away? Or why is Scholastic the one giving the school the option to pull that away?
And it goes back to the idea of curriculum type things, right? These parents come in and they want to ban, you know, whatever it is, because their child shouldn't learn about it. But what about the 29 other kids in that classroom? So now you are telling these other parents how to parent their kids, yet they're all about like, ooh, we want to, everybody should have choice. Well, yeah, then, but you're taking it away from other students. I don't know. Sarah, you look like you want to say something.
Oh, I've got so much to say on this topic. I think they've taken a stance in the wrong place. A Scholastic Book Fair is an option. Like it's not a part of the curriculum. It's literally something that kids bring their $5, $10, whatever to school and they purchase something and take it home.
And most of them purchase posters. Curriculum. They don't purchase books. Right. They purchase erasers and posters. Let's be honest.
Pencils.
And the stupid wiggly pencils. Let's be honest. It's all the stuff right by the cash register.
So that's where I really just, it frustrates me that like such a big publisher would take such a wimpy stance on all of these things with book bans and things like that going on. We have quite an epidemic, if you will, about books and people using pure ignorance to try to ban books they haven't even read and going to their school board and saying, we can't allow this here. And it's a really big problem. How it ever got started is beyond me that we really feel this passionate to ban books from kids who are just trying to learn.
This story, when I was reading it, it reminded me of we watched a video a couple days ago in our professional development, and it was a woman from Nigeria who was an author. She was talking about how when she was growing up, she was very fortunate to have books to read in the community she lived in, but all those books were English books in America, and how she never in those books saw anyone that looked like her or anyone who had a culture that that matched hers, and how that just affected her worldview. It warped her worldview. And it just got her worldview away from what the world was really like. And to deny kids the right, these books are now available for kids to have, to see people from different cultures, or maybe from their own culture, that they don't get to see in these positions very often. And you're now pulling that away from the kids getting the opportunity to see that. And I think that just sucks for the kids.
Sarah, to go back to your question about how did we get here, I think I know how we got here, but that's a conversation to have at our lunch table.
Sounds like a good plan. I feel like we could talk about a lot of things on this topic.
All right. Well, any last thoughts on that topic before we wrap it up today?
No, it's mind blowing to me. That's all my last comment. It's just unbelievable.
As an educator, I think my biggest thing to people always, like they have new babies, I'm like, read to them every day, read to them everything and anything. And here we are, can't even have a book fair without, you know, adding a little bit of censorship to it.
Yep. No, I think that's a really good way to wrap up the show today. Really good point. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. And I know that our listeners are just lucky to have your insight. The value that you brought today was awesome on all three of the stories. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun, guys.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Please, guys, as always, do us a favor. You know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, please give us a like. Please give us a review. We appreciate all the feedback we get. We're really trying to build a community of teachers here. And we've got a Facebook page now, Beyond Standards Teaching, and an Instagram, Beyond Standards Teaching, with an underscore between the words. Please look us up. Give us a follow. Give us some feedback. Tell us what you like. Tell us your thoughts on the topics that we talked about today. Love to get more voices into the mix. This is Joe and Jeff signing off, reminding you to keep going above and beyond those standards, because you may not make a lot of money, but you do make a difference.